Good morning, and welcome to Loves on Movies. My name is Joey Lopes, and today I am joined by Connor.
Hey, how you doing, Joey?
I'm doing pretty good. And actually, Connor's the only person that I'm joined by, so we're doing a little twofer today. You know, just a one-on-one episode, you know.
A true Lopes on Movies.
A true Lopes on Movies, as it were. So this is, you know, this should be fun. We got a couple of things to talk about today. There haven't really been too many movies that we've been interested in going to theaters to see, or new movies that have come out on streaming that we've been interested in seeing. Actually, it's funny. Connor was in town just the other day, and we were looking at the HBO Max library and staring at the screen for what is it called? Those Who Wish Me Dead? Those Who Want Me Dead?
Those Who Want Me Dead.
I think it's Those Who Wish Me Dead.
Those Who Wish Me Dead, just like I said.
The Angelina Jolie movie with the kid, I think it was written and directed by Taylor Sheridan. And we couldn't bring ourselves to press play.
We did everything we could to, like...
I don't know, it's just there's something psychologically that just... You know, you convince yourself that you won't go to the theater, but you will watch it at home one of these days. But then you never get around to watching it at home because, like... You know, it's such a an ordeal to hit that play button on something like that, and ultimately we didn't. You know, we couldn't bring ourselves to do it because there was
I thought it was going to be enough for you because you were such a big fan of the director's, you know, Taylor Sheridan's last movie. What was it?
Sicario, Day of the Soldado.
Yeah, Day of the Soldado.
I think he directed Day of the Soldado. I'm pretty sure. He didn't direct the first Sicario. That was Denis Villeneuve. I saw Day of the Soldado in theaters. Spoilers, that movie ends with, like, the Benicio del Toro character telling, like, a kid that was kind of in the movie for a large part of it. He's like, so you want to be a Sicario? It's like... Yeah. I couldn't believe it. Oh my God.
I think the Sicario is good, though. And, you know, this guy directed, or no, not directed, sorry. He's a writer first, I think. And now he's also directing. But he wrote Hell or High Water, which was a movie from a few years ago that I really like.
Yeah, that movie was good because that was some other director. I actually don't remember who it was, but I think he's somebody that was kind of coming up around that time. But yeah, the word on the street is, you know, Taylor Sheridan is a solid writer, but maybe he should not be behind the camera when it comes to, you know, his movies getting made. But, you know, you hate to say it. You know, it's the guy's trying to make movies. He's trying to be a director. You want to give him the the ability to make some kind of duds.
Yeah,
maybe
I guess
eventually he'll find kind of his voice.
I do think it's time to stop talking about something we didn't see.
That's true. You know, we should probably focus on some more pertinent stuff. Like, in the world of movies, there actually has been some interesting developments. Kind of some stuff that I wouldn't say we predicted, but that we've kind of been like hinting at over the past couple of months. But a few big moves in that direction have taken place. So May was the month of big media company mergers and acquisitions. So AT&T, who you may not be aware of this, but AT&T owned Warner Media. So Warner Media, of course, is what does HBO Max and, you know, all that. They are merging Warner Media with Discovery, and Discovery is the, you know, big conglomerate that owns, you know, HGTV, Animal Planet, Food Network, you know, all that stuff on TV. So they're merging that into one thing, which they just recently announced the name of the new company that's going to house all of these shows and everything, which is Warner Media, or I think it's Warner Bros. Discovery.
It's called Warner Bros. Discovery.
Warner Bros. Discovery. So very, very creative. They released like a logo online that everybody's making fun of because it just looks like Microsoft Word, like Word Art.
Yeah, and it is.
So very funny. But I mean, that's... You know, that's a pretty big move, obviously. And then the kind of more surprising one, and actually, like, kind of shocking when you look at the numbers, was Amazon buying MGM. Which of course MGM is one of the really historic movie production companies, and they acquired MGM for $8.45 billion. That's a lot.
Do you think that's a large number or not that much for like MGM, considering like the legacy of MGM?
The legacy is one thing, and so the whole thing was like, and there's this really like sinister quote during the acquisition where some like Amazon or representative was like, you know, the real financial value behind this deal is the treasure trove of IP in the deep catalog that we reimagine and develop. It's like, no, don't reimagine anything, please don't.
That was Bezos. Bezos himself.
Yeah, Bezos did say that. But the funny thing about that is that I don't really think MGM has like that much in terms of stuff that you would really want to like franchise worthy stuff. Like the only thing they really have is James Bond, which I feel like is kind of already something of a like, you know, has been property. You know what I mean?
I mean, James Bond cracks me up because they've had the same plot for every James Bond movie with Daniel Craig for the past like four films.
Yeah.
You know, the James Bond is getting older and doesn't quite have it all together yet, maybe. And then he seems to keep coming back. Yeah. So I'm looking at it right now. So they acquired from MGM. They've got James Bond, the Rocky franchises, the television show, The Handmaid's Tale, which is actually pretty popular. And then they also have the reality shows Shark Tank and Survivor, which I didn't know.
So, you know, it's just like a handful of things, but like when you're thinking in terms of like, you know, they're trying to develop, you know, reimagine these intellectual properties. It's like, what are they going to go to like the classic movies? Are we going to get a new 12 Angry Men?
I know. Okay, we're going to get a new Tomb Raider.
I don't know.
You know, whatever those are. Yeah, the quote is hilarious, though, from Bezos.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just... You hate to hear stuff like that. It's so dystopian. But the point being, like all of these companies, and we've talked about this before, they're trying to compete on these streaming services, and they realize that people are not going to pay like for, you know, 20 different streaming services. There's only so many. So all these mergers are happening so they can try to get their libraries all on one platform, which is what the Discovery thing was. Because I think Discovery actually had its own streaming service outside of like the HBO Max and everything before this. So like, you know, who's going to pay for the Discovery thing on its own? That seems kind of ridiculous.
Nobody.
But now with this merger, it's like, that'll probably just become a branch of HBO Max more likely than not. Cause I think they're really putting all of their eggs in the HBO Max basket, even though kind of funnily enough, I think just the other day, HBO Max like crashed right during the release of the season or series finale of that Mayor of Easttown show with Kate Winslet. You heard of this show? Apparently,
people
it's very
like
popular.
That. People like
it was
that,
one of like
yeah.
the most watched like shows on HBO in like a really long time.
Yeah.
But the point being, it crashed like when this series finale came out. So it's not a great look. But you know, I digress. Point being, all these companies are trying to get their streaming platforms to compete with Netflix and be like as broad and valuable, and Disney Plus also, obviously. But these mergers are getting really, really kind of terrifying, because we're getting to a point now where we were already kind of close to this point, but we're getting even closer to a point where these media companies are just like a tiny handful. It's like monopolizing the industry like crazy, which is just terrible for making good art.
Yeah, it's bad. Yeah, I mean, it's mergers, acquisitions, and getting the rights to play things and create them. Like Netflix's strategy, remember we were talking about a while ago, is they are just trying to buy as much content as possible. Yes. They bought Knives Out with the sequels, Daniel Craig, crazy amount of money for that. And I think they actually announced some stuff with the new Knives Out also. It's going to have like a crazy star-studded cast for like the sequels. And I don't remember any of them off the top of my head. But it's just like all the names were just like big, like wow. But that's what they're doing. They're just acquiring all the content. Like Netflix is also going to have all the Sony stuff now, like all the Sony, new Sony movies for a while. Yeah, it's just collecting those IPs. It's the great streaming wars.
It just makes me really like wonder, at what point does this become a problem where, like, like an antitrust problem. You know what I mean? Mm. Like, that is what happened back in the, like, in the 40s, I think, was when the Paramount decree was, which was the thing that made it so movie studios couldn't own theaters, right? Mm-hmm. And which was repealed, of course, which was not so great. Right. Yep. Also making this problem even worse. But that was the whole point of that was to make it so that these movie studios couldn't monopolize the industry, which ended up leading to, you know, pretty much a golden period for experimentation in Hollywood. It was great. But now we're getting back to a point where just a handful of companies own everything. And I don't know, it just seems at some point that this shouldn't be that way. You know, someone's gotta intervene here. And maybe that's just wishful thinking. I don't know.
It's wishful thinking, unfortunately. Yeah. You know, like, yeah. At this point, let's just hope they keep all the catalogs of the movies that they have in their collection pure and unaltered and available. Remember, didn't Martin Scorsese show up to like the Disney studios to meet with them? And then everyone was like, oh, but Martin Scorsese, after all he said, is going to Disney. And really, it was a meeting to make sure that all the content that they had that was going to be like preserved and not like ruined.
Yeah, exactly. It was all about preserving their vast historical legacy.
That's going to be the case with everything now, you know, like everything is going to fall into that.
Well, the real like devastating part of this, if it happens, is that basically what these companies are trying to do is get you to subscribe to the streaming services, and then they control what you're able to watch or not watch. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they can put something on the platform, then take it off and then never put it back on, and you'll never see it again. So it's really, it's terrible for curation on the bigger platforms like that. And, you know, they don't want you to own movies because they want to be able to, you know, sell you subscriptions. They don't want you to get physical media anymore. But physical media is really the best way to be able to own really anything and, you know, watch it whenever you want and never lose it. So it's still a very, very much viable method if you're interested in movies in a serious way. Really, physical media is the best way to go. But it's, yeah, I don't know. I think it's, we're entering a perilous time, Connor. For movie distribution in a kind of a paradoxical way, because of how easy it is to watch things, it's paradoxically also very easy for the companies that own all of these things to just make their stuff barely available, except for like a handful of things that they decide to make available whenever they want. I don't know, scary. But
yeah, why would they let you buy something once when they can make you buy it again and again and again and again through the streaming services, you know?
Yeah, get that monthly subscription, you know? Well, that's, enough depressing stuff, you know? It's an ongoing story. We'll see where this goes. The important thing is that we have some movies to talk about. Me and you watched a decent amount of things. We're just going to kind of go through a handful of them, maybe. So, Connor, what's some stuff you've been watching lately that I haven't seen?
Let's see. The one most recently I saw, Memories of Murder, the Bong Joon-ho film.
Right. You told me you were going to watch that.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, familiar with that one. I think you are. The Criterion Channel has been promoting this one a bit, I'm pretty sure, the past bunch of weeks. And it's great. It's one of the first big like Bong Joon-ho movies. It was huge here. Came out in 2003. It's based on a real story too, about a serial killer in Korea that took place back in the 80s. And if you know anything about like Korea in the 80s, there was some crazy like protesting and everything that was happening there. So it was that was kind of covered in this too. It's very well done. It's about like these detectives who are trying to find this killer who's been killing multiple young women and has like a common like pattern that's going on, like
MO.
Yeah, classic serial killer thing. And it's very interesting. You see the way there's probably some good police, some bad police, and then you see the way the good police become bad police, and then just like it's very well done, and part of like Bong Joon-ho's like style has been to be like somewhat critical from like his filmmaking of the current like status of what's going on in Korea throughout all of like history.
Sure.
And that's what actually has put him on some kind of, like, the government has not always been a fan of Bong Joon-ho for that reason, because his movies are not entirely like, you know, this is great. Everything's going so great here, you know?
Patriotic.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if you even watch, you know, I think most people saw Parasite. That's the thing that most people him for. That movie is pretty, you know, clear what they're going for there about the disparity between the very rich and the very poor, that in the dichotomy of that. And then, you know, but yeah, this one, Memories of Murder, is really good. I'd recommend this to anyone. And this also stars the same guy who was the star in Parasite. That's kind of like Bong has a bit of an ensemble, but this guy Song always appears in his things. He's the one who played like the father of the poor family and like the driver in Parasite. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Song is like the detective in this one, like one of the lead detectives that we see. Mm-hmm. And you got to give him credit because he's like the biggest star in Korea, right? One of the biggest actors. Mm-hmm. And he takes on these roles that are not very like, they're not at all. Like, this guy is not a good guy. Like, he's like, so in the film, he's like constantly just trying to find who the murderer is, and then will take these leaps to like to the point of like interrogating people so much so that they just admit to doing something, and they're like, all right, got him, and then this is it.
Right. Yeah,
Like, it's very interesting because the way they do some of the parts, it's done in such a way that you want to laugh, but at the same time you're like, wait, why should I be laughing at this is like terrible. But that's just his style. He's a great filmmaker. Right. So, and I think it was pretty clear from you know, this came out in 2003, that he had some really good potential, and obviously winning Best Director's film wins Best Picture, Parasite in the future. It's, you know, goes to show a lot of great international movies out there, Joey. You know?
Oh, yes, there are. Absolutely. I mean, it's really a treasure trove of stuff once you get over what did Bong Joon-ho say? The tiny fence of watching subtitles.
Yeah, the subtitles. That's right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It's kind of a funny crack, because it's like, it's really not that hard to watch a movie with subtitles. You just got to, you know, get over that little tiny barrier, you know, just do it.
Some people in you know, the United States, like these people I find are to be crazy. I don't know if you've seen this before, but some people will stream something and watch a show or anything with the subtitles on in English.
Oh, yeah. That's crazy to me.
That's something I can't understand, but some people can't watch anything without it.
I mean, I understand if you're hard of hearing like that.
No, these are like people who are not hard of hearing that still do it.
Yeah, that's weird to me.
I don't get it.
To me, subtitles are like, and this is why, like, I always run into this, like, you know, not an ethical dilemma, but the dilemma when you're trying to watch something from another country that has a dub or a sub, and like, on the one hand, if you watch the sub, you're getting the original performances of the actors and, you know, what was originally intended, but because you don't understand them, you have to spend, like, you know, 75% of the movie looking at the bottom two-thirds of the screen, reading text. So you miss things that are in the image. And of course, you know, movies are, you know, a visual medium. You don't want to miss things. You want to be able to pay attention to the whole, you know, you don't want your eyes to be like automatically drifting to one part of the screen all the time. You know, like, your eyes are always darting around the screen when you watch a movie. So that's why sometimes I'm like, oh, you know, I'd rather watch the dub, because at least then I don't have to have my eyes trained on one tiny part of the screen, you know. But then you run into the problem where, like, sometimes the dubs just, you know, don't really hit the spirit of the original, or just aren't very good in general. Mm-hmm. Occasionally they do hit, and like, and they are like really well done. Like, I think, like, honestly, I think a lot of the dubs for the Studio Ghibli movies that I think Disney did a lot of those are very professionally done. I think those are generally pretty good.
For animation, it's easier to do.
Oh, sure, yeah, definitely for animation. But then again, I mean, in the Italian film industry of like the
I was going to bring that
whatever,
up. Yeah,
they didn't record any audio on set and dubbed everything in post, including the original language. So, you know, you watch The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, or whatever, and you know, you're looking at a dub, and you can tell kind of, like, for the most part.
Yeah,
but it's just
kinda,
like,
it's
it doesn't
somewhat
matter,
bizarre,
you know,
way to do things that they did for those spaghetti westerns, to just have every single actor from wherever they were act in their language.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Like, but I mean, that was, to me, that's kind of cool, you know?
I do, like, think it's cool.
It puts a greater emphasis on the fact that, especially back then, the focus of the filmmaking was not the dialogue, it was the visual, right? Mm-hmm. And like Fellini would, like we talked about 8.5 at one point on this show, like Fellini would, I'm pretty sure for a large part of 8.5 wasn't even like written by the time he started shooting, and mm-hmm. he wrote like lines for the actors to dub in later, so he didn't even know what they were gonna say when he filmed the scenes. It's just like an interesting way of doing things. But yeah, I can understand, like, especially like, you know, dubbing kind of has a in live action, at least, has kind of a little bit of a reputation just because of like the, you know, like the kung fu movies and stuff, and you know, it's, everybody likes to joke about that kind mm-hmm. of thing. But I don't know, I think it's not necessarily a terrible option if you can get over the fact that you're watching something that you can tell is dubbed. But again, you know, it doesn't matter for the spaghetti westerns. Why should it matter for anything else? I don't know. That's my two cents. I just think the visual component is really nice to keep in mind. But of course, you know, in most cases, you are going to watch subtitled for foreign movies.
Yeah. Anyway, Joey, what are you watching?
So I could talk about one thing that I watched recently. So we actually just recently on our Instagram page, we put up a rerun of our episode on Ennio Morricone, because it's almost been a year since he passed away. I think he passed away in July of 2020, mm-hmm. and we did a long episode, just kind of tribute to Morricone and just his work. And just recently on the Criterion channel, they have a big series on Morricone happening, where it's just a handful of movies that he scored, mostly movies that, not the typical movies, like not all of the Leone movies. Like, it does have DocuSucker, which is mm-hmm. one of the weirder Leone movies, so I can understand why it's on there, but there's a lot of stuff on there that is kind of off the beaten path, which I think is really cool. But there are also a couple that are like some of his more acclaimed scores that maybe like you might not have seen. Like, and so one of these movies, for example, was The Mission, which I watched. And The Mission was a movie from 1986 that was, I mean, this is kind of a dumb observation, but it's kind of like Silence, Martin Scorsese's Silence, and that it focuses on Jesuit priests from that era. This time they're on not on a mission to Japan, which was Silence, but on a mission in South America. It stars both Jeremy Irons and Robert De Niro playing these Jesuit priests, and I think the movie has had kind of like not a bad reception, but sort of like middling reception, especially at the time. I think some people thought it was a little bit like maybe saccharine or kind of like on the nose in a lot of respects. And I can understand that, but I really felt that a lot of the movie worked really well. And I think it's a movie that really, really plays on the strength of the visual and the music, because like just like the opening of the movie, we have Jeremy Irons is like scaling a waterfall to this beautiful Ennio Morricone music. And it's so like earthy and real looking, like it looks like a guy actually like climbing a waterfall, you know, like barefoot with the water like crashing down on him, while wow. this really, really beautiful score is playing. And it's just like instantly from that moment, I was like, I'm in.
You know? How would you describe the score?
It's interesting because it kind of plays with two different, so obviously like the whole bit with the Jesuit priests is that they were missionary trips to like indigenous tribes, or they were trying to like, you know, teach them Christianity. Right.
Right.
So it was kind of like a in the score, what Morricone would do is merge Western influences with more indigenous, instrumentation. So you would sometimes have your standard kind of Western orchestral music, and then you would sometimes have more indigenous kind of tribal music. And he would blend that in a really interesting way. But there's the thing that's interesting about this score is that it was actually really, really well received at the time, in that it was nominated for the Oscar for Best Picture. And everybody was pretty sure he was going to win for this, except that he didn't.
Yeah.
And he was actually pretty surprised by this, because the movie that won was Round Midnight, which is a really good movie about that stars Dexter Gordon, who's a great jazz saxophonist, it's sort of like an amalgamation of jazz figures that it's about, which is a really great movie. And the score was done by Herbie Hancock, who is, of course, you know, pioneer, like incredible jazz musician. But the like controversial aspect of that was that the score used a lot of songs that basically rearrangements of existing material, which is, you know, common in jazz, reinterpreting songs, the standards, whatever. But the Mission score is obviously completely, you know, new. It's a composed specifically for the movie, and that's it. So Morricone was a little bit aggrieved by that.
Yeah.
Like he was of course he praised the score for Around Midnight, but it was kind of an interesting surprise. And then Morricone ended up never winning an Oscar until The Hateful Eight.
Yeah, which is crazy. You
know, yeah, like way late.
And that was a great score, but that was more like a lifetime achievement award.
Oh, definitely. One. It was, you know, he was getting old at that point, and they realized, like, you know, we better give it to him now, because if we don't, that'll be a completely ridiculous thing.
Yeah.
For you know, considering he's, you know, in my opinion, the greatest film composer of all time. But
oh yeah, yeah.
Whatever you want to call it. But yeah, that's just some of what I've been watching. I think it's a good movie. I think I would recommend people check it out, if only because the seeing a movie shot on location in that way, it's, you never see things like this anymore. Like it's a really, really visceral experience.
Just because I've seen Silence, and you compared it to Silence a little bit. Does it get as like heavy as Silence? Like going, because Silence was about like,
well,
the Jesuit priest being like basically tortured into apostatizing, not killed.
Right.
Like they were, you know, they were being tortured to like give up their faith, you know?
Right.
So it went really deep. So how would you say this one handles that side?
Well, I think Silence is a really, really harrowing movie.
Yes.
And like,
yeah,
the Mission definitely gets to a point of, you know, like tragedy and despair. But like, I feel like Silence is kind of implicit in it as a more critical look at the period of time and what the Jesuits were doing in particular, whereas the Mission doesn't really have much time for that. It's like, this is why people, I think, consider it a kind of saccharine, right? Because it's very much a, you know, the priests are the good guys in this scenario.
Oh,
like,
okay.
The government are the bad guys, and they want to like take this land away from the Jesuit priests, but they don't want to give it up. So then they end up like going to battle over it, and of course it doesn't end very well. So it's very much like a martyr situation, right?
Gotcha.
Whereas in Silence, we're talking, you know, a much more complicated and dark movie that really, really sticks with you in a more heady kind of way. But I think the Mission is still good. It's still a very like very beautiful and visceral movie. Just definitely a different experience. But I will say this, to one final note to end on, that's really kind of funny. Liam Neeson is in the Mission.
How about that? You know.
So I was, you know, just because I'm an idiot, I wanted to believe that it was the same character. from the Mission to
he's like
to Silence.
He's just a young Jesuit priest at the beginning. You know. Mm-hmm. That was his first mission, and then he at some point made it over to Japan, and then, you know,
things didn't go too well for him.
And then things didn't go that great. Although I don't know, maybe I can't actually remember. Was he no, he wasn't happy, I don't think.
No,
he was pretty. No. Yeah, that movie's great. I'd also recommend Silence.
It is a good movie. I need to watch that again.
Yeah.
That was really something.
Yeah, even though Silence kind of killed Martin Scorsese in theaters for a studio to
Yeah, that is true. This is kind of a bummer, but hey, you know, let's not worry about it. He made a great movie. That's all that matters.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, everybody, we'll see you next week with some more good stuff. So have a good one.